Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abai Omega, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Tuesday, April the 23rd, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. Later on, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on various issues involving the struggles that are going on right now in Palestine and throughout the African continent. And, of course, the episode features dispatches on the demonstrations in the United States at university campuses in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Also, nearly 300 bodies have been found in a mass grave in Gaza outside the Nasser Hospital. We'll have details on that as well. The European Union and the United Kingdom are sending funds to Somalia for security purposes. And 110 people in Mali have been abducted by rebels inside that West African state. In the second hour, we listen to a rare archival audio file of Dr. W.B. Du Bois speaking on his life's journey and mission. Finally, we hear a audio file featuring Langston Hughes, Otis Spann, Studs Terkel, and others discussing African-American music, both secular as well as sacred. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program, so stay tuned. Right now, we'll take our musical interlude with music from the band entitled The African Brothers Band, and this is a track right from the album entitled A Tribute to DK. Let's listen in.
Oh,
From the West African state of Ghana, from the African Brothers Band. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Tuesday, April the 23rd, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we'd like to take our Pan-African Newswire report. The lead stories in today's Pan-African Newswire deal with the pro-Palestinian protests, which are gaining momentum at United States universities, with students raging against the seats of learning's connections to the Israeli regime and Washington's all-out support for Tel Aviv's ongoing genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. A large group of demonstrators has established a Gaza solidarity encampment at Columbia University, where hundreds of students have been calling on the university to divest from companies that have ties to the Israeli regime. As means of trying to confront the rallies, university authorities announced that classes would be held virtually yesterday. Earlier in the week, authorities called on the police, who rounded up more than 100 protesters. The move sparked a bigger turnover over the weekend. Over 200 students camped on the grounds of the prestigious Columbia University grounds in New York a day after police arrested more than 100 protesters. Protests also spread to other campuses, including the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, New York University, the University of Michigan, and Yale University. Also yesterday, at least 47 people were arrested at Yale after reportedly refusing requests to disperse. Students who were arrested also will be referred for Yale disciplinary action, which includes a range of sanctions such as reprimand, probation, or suspension. The university said this in a statement. Yale students threaten hunger strikes over the university's connection to U.S. arms manufacturers that contribute to Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. United States President Joe Biden has denounced the students' protest, saying he condemned those whom he alleged, quote, don't understand what is going on with the Palestinians, unquote. The country has been throwing unreserved political, military, and intelligence support behind the war that the Israeli regime began on October 7th of last year, following a retaliatory operation by Gaza's resistance groups. At least 34,097 people have died across the Palestinian territory ever since the onset of the military onslaught. Women and children comprise some 72% of the victims of the war, which has also wounded as many as 76,980 others. Also in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli occupation should be held accountable for the deliberate crimes it is committing against Palestinians in Gaza. Spokesman for the Palestinian Red Crescent said this yesterday. Gaza's civil defense announced yesterday that 283 bodies of martyrs were recovered from the Israeli-made mass grave in Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis since the withdrawal of the Israeli occupation forces from the area. There is clear evidence of field executions carried out by the Israeli occupation forces at Nasser Medical Complex, it emphasized in a statement. Among the hundreds of bodies the Israeli forces buried in mass graves at Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza was one with his hands bound and clothes wrapped in medical scrubs. The spokesperson of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, Nabal Farsak, condemned the international community's state of silence on the Israeli war on Gaza. In a press conference, Farsak said that since the start of the war in Gaza, the international community has not taken any serious action towards the continuous Israeli crimes and violations against the health system, hospitals, humanitarian workers, and civilians in Gaza. The Israeli occupation should be held accountable for the deliberate crimes that it is committing against Palestinians in Gaza, she stressed, then added that the PRCS is facing many hurdles in the Strip, one of which is the deliberate Israeli targeting of the organization, especially amid the scarcity of medical and relief supplies in the Gaza Strip. You are listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In other news, Somalia has earned new money to help it upgrade its security services and what officials said will help combat its perennial problems related to attacks by al-Shabaab. This week on Tuesday, the European Union said it had approved 116 million euros, some 117 million U.S. dollars for stabilization efforts in Somalia via its Political and Security Committee. The statement said, quote, Council approves further support under the European Peace Facility to the Somali National Army and to the military component of the African Union's transition mission in Somalia. The EU added that it would add $75 million to the resources already mobilized for the transition mission in Somalia in previous years, covering July 1st, 2021 to December 31st of 2023. And finally, in the West African state of Mali, local groups and officials in Mali are calling for the release of more than 110 people kidnapped by suspected jihadists 6 days ago. They told the Agence France-Presse news agency that three buses carrying the civilians were stopped by a group of men in the center of the country and forced to head towards a forest between Badigara and Bankass. An elected official from Bandigara, who asked to remain anonymous for security reasons, says the buses and passengers are still being held captive. Since 2012, Mali has been plagued by fighting between different factions affiliated with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group, as well as by self-declared self-defense forces and criminals. The worsening security situation has been compounded by a humanitarian and political crisis. The violence spilled over into neighboring Burkina Faso and Niger, with all three countries seeing military regimes taking power in recent years. With that, we will conclude our segment of the Pan-African Newswire. In concluding this segment of the Pan-African Journal, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Tuesday, April the 23rd, 2024, go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. You can reach the Pan-African Radio Network by logging on to blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Howlin' Wolf with the track entitled I Can't Stay Here. And right now we want to move into a rare archival audio file of Dr. W.B. Du Bois, born in 1868, made his transition in 1963, a scholar, activist, Pan-Africanist, Marxist. He, of course, made his transition in the West African state of Ghana during the First Republic under the presidency of Dr. Kwame Nkrumah of the Convention People's Party. Let's listen to this report.
I went from my home in Massachusetts when I was 17 down to Fisk University in Tennessee. There I stayed 3 years. Then I came from there to Harvard University in the fall of 85 and stayed there 4 years, 2 years in the college and 2 years in the graduate department. Then I went to Berlin and stayed 2 years. At Fisk, we had an institution for Negroes, taught for the most part by white people who were graduates of Oberlin and of Yale. The college was after the New England tradition, the regular college with Latin and Greek and mathematics and history and so forth. Comparatively small classes, because in the whole college department there were only about 25. Very good teachers, and the general surroundings, except the white city, but the general surroundings inside the college were excellent. For instance, I think that my long years of life are due perhaps more to one thing that I learned at Fisk, and that was to go to bed at 10 o'clock at night. Then, of course, there was what was to me the new experience of being with my own group of people. In New England, I was usually the one colored pupil with surrounding white pupils. It wasn't until I began to get along in the teens that I felt any differences, and there the differences were comparatively small. And yet, as I look back, I can see that probably I felt myself rather the exception. Now, on the other hand, I go down to Fisk University, and there suddenly I am in a Negro world where all the people except the teachers, and the teachers in their thought and action, belong to this colored world, and the world was almost complete. I mean, we acted and thought as people belonging to this group, and I got the idea that my work was in that group, that while I was in the long run going to try to break down segregation and separateness, yet for the time I was quite willing to be a Negro and to work within the Negro group. Now, I came from there to Harvard, and there was a change, and yet I met it in a peculiar sort of way. I mean, if I had gone directly from my high school in Great Barrington to Harvard, I would have thought of myself as a Massachusetts man, and my fellows would have been the whites there. But coming from Fisk, I brought with me the feeling of a separate race. I never felt myself a Harvard man as I had felt myself a Fisk man. I was coming to Harvard for a particular purpose, to try to carry further the education that I had received at Fisk, but to work by myself, to seek no contact with my fellows. If they wanted to know me, they had to make the effort on their part. So that out of my class of 300, I don't suppose I knew 10 really intimately at all. Now, of course, in Boston, there were colored people. There were some colored students in other institutions. There were very few colored students at Harvard, only one or two beside myself during my whole term there. But there were colored people in Massachusetts, and I had a very pleasant social life with them, so that I was not lonely at all, and I enjoyed the life there. Then, too, Harvard was in an exceptional state of being at that time. I don't think that from 1885 to this day there has been quite such an aggregation of teachers and preachers and lecturers as there were then. My closest friend, for instance, as a teacher was William James, a great sociologist, the brother of Henry James. I knew him well. I was invited to his house and we talked together. Then there was George Santayana, who died at a ripe old age not very long ago. He and I read the Kritik der reinen Vernunft together alone up in an attic room. There was Channing, the historian, and a great many of the greater names in history were connected more or less with the institution. Moreover, the institution was going through a change. It had been up until that time distinctly a New England institution with Puritan ancestry and rather provincial. But the men who had come in the last few years wanted it to be more of a national institution, and they therefore offered scholarships to people in the Middle West and in the South. Now it happened that I had always thought as a boy that I was going to Harvard because it was the largest institution and was in my own state. But I had, as a matter of fact, no money to go there, so that the scholarship was offered me at Fisk, and I went to Fisk, but still with the idea that sometime I was going to Harvard. When, therefore, these scholarships were offered, I applied, and I got a scholarship, which would pay my expenses and something more, and therefore went to Harvard at this time. Now, that landed me at Harvard at a time of great intellectual activity and of a new freedom of thought and action. William James was beginning his pragmatism. There was a wide study of art under Charles Eliot Norton. There was the new methods in history under Channing and under Albert Bushnell Hart. Hart later became my special teacher. When I went there, I had made up my mind I was going to study philosophy. That is, I wanted to study the thought of what the meaning of the whole universe was. But after I got there and had studied one or two years under James, we had a frank talk. And James said, "Now, if you've got to study philosophy, you will. But if you can get out of it, you better, because it's difficult to make a living at philosophy." So I gave up philosophy and went into history under Albert Bushnell Hart. I had some assignments in Negro history, and was very, very much interested in the work that I was doing, and it was work also that he particularly wanted done, so that eventually I took several courses for my broader education, courses in chemistry and in mathematics and in geology, and then finally began to concentrate on history, and especially the history of the Negro in the United States and later in Africa. I got my bachelor's degree with distinction in 1890 and was one of the six commencement speakers out of my class of 300. And characteristically, I took as my subject Jefferson Davis. Jefferson Davis as a representative of civilization, and tried to be very fair and frank in saying that the kind of civilization that he represented, the might of the white race suppressing the rest of the world, was a thing that we didn't need and wouldn't want in the next century. It proved a rather popular subject, and there was a good deal of talk about it. Then I applied for a fellowship and got a fellowship for a year. At the in the midst of that year, I was at a party and somebody called my attention to what Rutherford B. Hayes, ex-president of the United States, had been saying down at Johns Hopkins. Now, what he talked about brought up a rather peculiar incident, or rather the incident was the reason of his talk. I've said at Harvard they were trying to keep the New England aristocrats from running the whole thing. And in my class was a black man from St. Louis who was one of the best speakers, best users of English that I ever knew, Clement Morgan. And when it came to the election of class officers, always the class officers had been Lowells and Cabots and Saltonstalls and so forth, and the class revolted and elected Morgan as class orator, which was unprecedented. They talked about it all over the United States. Well, Rutherford Hayes at that time was head of the Slater Fund, which was money left by a Connecticut millionaire to educate Negroes. So he went down to Johns Hopkins University and said that the fund was willing to educate Negroes, but they had only been able to find orators. Well, I got mad at that, and I wrote Mr. Hayes and told him that I could get some professors to tell him that I was doing pretty good work there and that I should like to go and study in Germany. That was a time when every American who wanted to get a real position in a university had to go to Germany to get his degree. Well, Mr. Hayes wrote back politely and said that the fund had offered some money for scholarships for Negroes, but that they were not offering any then. And then I wrote him a pretty impudent letter and said that he owed somebody an apology. He had no business to go down to a southern university and speak about a scholarship being offered and not being able to find anybody. As a matter of fact, I never had heard of any scholarships being offered, and I couldn't find out from anyone else that they had heard. Well, he wrote a very apologetic letter and said he was sorry, and that he would take up the matter the next year if I wished. So the next year I started on him again, and I got everybody from the president of Harvard down, and he was simply overwhelmed with recommendations, and so I got a fellowship. Meantime, I had gotten a renewal of my fellowship so that I was 2 years in the Harvard Graduate School. Then I got this fellowship to go to Germany. It was $750. And half of it was a gift and half was to be paid back after I'd finished my education. I eventually paid it back with interest at 6%. I went to Germany, and there, of course, I had a tremendous new experience. For the first time in my life, I was just a human being and not a particular kind of human being. I remember getting on the boat at Rotterdam to make the Rhine-Reise, the journey up the Rhine, and there was a Dutch lady and three daughters, two grown and one about 12, on the boat. So I followed out the custom that I would have in America. I got in part of the boat where they were not. I mean, if they got toward the bow, I went toward the other end. Until finally the little girl walked straight over to me and asked what language I spoke, and I told her that I spoke English and a little German. And then the mother came over, and we became just a little group of travelers. We were the only ones on the small boat, and had a beautiful trip up the Rhine from Rotterdam to Cologne. It was a new experience, of course, to me, and a very inspiring one. Then I went to Eisenach in the Rhine-Pfalz and spent a summer with the family of a professor. And they had two daughters and some boarders, French and English, and we had a lovely summer. And from there in the fall I went to Berlin. In Berlin I had the chance to get into a seminar, which was rather unusual for a foreigner, but I was allowed in this seminar on economics under two of the most prominent professors. And for three semesters I studied there. I wanted to take the examination, but the rule was that you could not come up for examination until you had been three semesters at the university. And I had only been two, and I only had money for that. They tried to make an exception, but the English professor had a lot of candidates, so that no difference could be made. I brought to their attention the fact that I had already had 2 years at Harvard, but they didn't recognize Harvard as being of the same rank as Berlin. So that I had to come back without my degree. On the other hand, it's rather interesting to know that last year, when I was in Berlin, that the university brought out my records and gave me the degree that I didn't get some 70 years before. I came back from Berlin in 1892, and then there was the question as to where and what I was going to work in the United States. There wasn't, of course, the slightest chance of my getting any position in a white university, in spite of the fact that I had had better education than most white students had had. First, I tried to see if I could get in a colored school, either a college or even a public school. One public school down in Tennessee considered me for a while, but thought I had rather too much education for them. Then I got an offer from Wilberforce. Now, I knew something about Wilberforce. Wilberforce, at first, was known as Tawawa Springs out in southern Ohio, where a good many Southerners used to come up for their vacations. Then it became a place where they sent their colored children for education. And finally, it was bought by the Negro Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and they established a college there. And I was offered a position there, which I accepted immediately, $800 a year. Just after I had accepted that, I got an offer from Tuskegee, Booker Washington. If I had got that offer first, I would have taken it, but I had already promised to go to Wilberforce, so that I didn't. Then I got another offer from Missouri at $1,500 a year. But money didn't mean anything to me then. I had offered to go to Wilberforce. I didn't know anything about this Missouri institution, and still I went to Wilberforce. There I stayed 2 years, rather difficult years. The institution, of course, was a rather low grade, but with a great deal of devotion and enthusiasm, and I had ideas of turning it into a great German institution of learning. I ran against the religious difficulties. Well, in other ways. For instance, I wore my cane and gloves always, because in Germany, if you didn't wear cane and gloves, you were practically naked. I'd never been a person with a very great sense of religion. I was fairly orthodox, but certainly not fundamental. And so I walk with my cane and gloves into a prayer meeting and sit down at the back, and then the student who was carrying on the prayer meeting says, "We will be led in prayer by Professor Du Bois." And I said, "No, you won't." And I came near losing my job there because the bishops were outraged. Of course, everybody led in prayer there, and they had revivals. Well, that made initial difficulties, and I knew that in the end they would get rid of me because I wasn't orthodox enough. Still, I had a nice 2 years there, and I had some very good students, and we did some extra good work. The only difficulty was I was teaching Latin and Greek when my specialty was sociology, and they didn't have any sociology, and they didn't want me to teach it. Then I got my chance. I was asked to come to the University of Pennsylvania to make a study of the Negro population of the 7th Ward of Philadelphia. The people of Philadelphia were quite certain that the bad political actions of these Negroes caused all the bad government in Philadelphia. But they knew that was true, but they wanted it proved in an academic way. Of course, I couldn't be an instructor. I couldn't be a scholar because I already had my PhD from Harvard, but they made me an assistant instructor, which meant that I didn't do any instruction, but that I did make this study. And I made it on my own plan. I didn't ask the department what to do. I laid before them a plan of study, and they accepted it. And in a year and a half work, I made this study of the Philadelphia Negro, which even today is recognized as a good sort of social study. And it's been very widely used. That was my second book. My first book was my thesis at Harvard, which became the first number of the Harvard Historical Series. Then, after I finished this study at the University of Pennsylvania, or before I finished it, the question with me was how this kind of study could be carried on and applied to the whole Negro problem in the United States, because, as I said and increasingly believed, the Negro problem was a matter of knowledge, that we were talking about it and we didn't know anything about it, that just because a man was born a Negro didn't mean that he knew what all the other millions were doing, and that what we needed was an academic study of the American Negro. And I wanted University of Pennsylvania and Harvard and Yale and so forth to go into a sort of partnership by which this kind of study could be forwarded. But they, of course, didn't do anything at all. But Atlanta University, which was a Negro institution down in Atlanta, Georgia, asked me to come down there and teach and take charge of such a study. So that in 1897, I went to Atlanta University and stayed there 13 years, making a systematic study of the American Negro, which wasn't well done because we didn't have money enough or personnel to carry it out. But nevertheless, it's fair to say that for the next 25 years, there wasn't a book published on the Negro problem that didn't have to depend upon what we were doing at Atlanta University. It was the first study of the sort. Ours was the first institution in the United States, white or black, that had any course on the history of the American Negro, or on Negro history in general. So that it was a good beginning. But while I was there, my faith in knowledge as a solution of the Negro problem was shaken. Lynching was common. Before I went away from there, there was an average of one lynching every week for some years. And it was a terrible sort of thing. There was one case very near Atlanta in which I knew from my studies just what had happened. It was a case of a Negro peasant not receiving his wages at the end of the season. He got in a fight with his hirer and killed him and ran away. And then when they couldn't find him, they raised the altogether new issue that he had raped the man's wife, which was evidently just dragged in. Well, I had a letter, which I hadn't delivered, to Joel Chandler Harris, the author of the Uncle Remus Tales. He was then on the Atlanta Constitution. So I took that letter and started downtown to deliver it to him and to talk to him about this situation. And on the way down, I found that this Negro, Sam Hose, had been caught and lynched, and that in the meat market, which was on the way I had to pass, his fingers and toes were being exhibited. Well, I didn't deliver the letter. I went back to Atlanta University. And then I made up my mind that knowledge wasn't enough, that even if people were ignorant of essential matters which they had to know, they wouldn't correct their actions without more realization of just what the difficulties were. They had not only to know, but they had to act. And so I changed from studying the Negro problem to propaganda, to letting people know just what the Negro problem meant in what the colored people were suffering and what they were kept from doing. I was practically compelled to make this change because the people who were supporting Atlanta University were a little uneasy about the way in which I talked about the Negro problem. And pressure began to be put upon the university to do without my services. I had begun to criticize Booker Washington, saying it wasn't enough to teach Negroes trades. The Negroes had to have some voice in their government. They had to have protection in the courts, and they had to have trained men to lead them. Well, all this together put such pressure upon Atlanta University that at last I resigned. I mean, they would have had to drop me if they wanted to keep the philanthropic gifts that were coming from the rich people of the North. So that I accepted an invitation to come to New York in 1910 and help the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. I had attended their conference in 1909. I became one of the incorporators and founders of the association. I came up in 1910 and was slated to be the secretary of the organization. But I didn't want to be secretary because secretary raises money and I couldn't raise money. What I wanted to do was to write and to talk. So I came up and, after some difficulty, persuaded them to let me found the Crisis Magazine, a little monthly magazine which would discuss the Negro problem and which would tell white people and colored people just what the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People was and what it proposed to do. Well, the magazine was founded in November 1910, and I edited it for 23 years. And In that time, I think I made the people of the United States, and especially the colored people, realize just what the Negro problem was and what they had got to do to solve it. I was pretty radical in some things I said. I made a good many enemies, but on the other hand, the magazine became self-supporting. It didn't cost the association anything. The magazine paid my salary and the expenses of publication, so that for 20 years, publicity was no expense to the NAACP. And on the other hand, I had very wide freedom in saying just what I wanted to say. I was looking over some copies the other day and came across an incident where a prominent man who was trustee of Haverford College wrote to cancel his subscription. That was in 1925. He said that to his horror, when he was in London in 1924, he found that we were picketing the Strand with placards concerning lynching in the United States, and he thought that was a very bad way of washing the dirty linen of our own country in a foreign land. And I read with great amusement the reply that I had made. I was going to wash that linen anywhere that I got soap and water. And while I was sorry to lose his support, nevertheless, that's the sort of thing we were going to do. That was the kind of talk I was going to indulge in. Well, of course, that was smart, but nevertheless, it didn't help the NAACP with a certain class of people in the United States. We, of course, met all sorts of problems. For instance, one of the first came with the First World War. There was the question of the draft. They passed laws by which colored soldiers were to go into separate camps, couldn't be trained with white soldiers, and then there were to be no colored officers. We fought for that, and finally we got a camp of colored officers, from which eventually 700 officers, mostly first and second lieutenants, with a few majors, one or two captains, they went to the front in France. But for the most part, the Negroes were used as stevedores rather than fighters. And of course, it was the material that we furnished Europe in this war that was the greatest importance. The fighting of Americans in the First World War was of no particular importance. The treatment of the colored soldiers over there was so bad that the NAACP sent me over just after the armistice to look into it. And I got the idea that here was a chance to do something for Africa. I wrote to President Wilson and told him that at the peace conference in Versailles, they ought to take up the matter of the German colonies, and since the Allies now are in charge, that they ought to set those colonies up as free, independent states and put them under an international committee on which Africans should be members. Mr. Wilson didn't answer that letter, but the American committee over there considered it, and out of that, really, came the Mandates Commission. On the other hand, when I got to Paris, I tried to organize a Pan-African Congress. There had been a Pan-African Conference in 1900, which I had attended and wrote the resolutions, but that had died. When I tried to organize this Pan-African Congress, I was told that Paris was under martial law and that we couldn't have anything of that sort. The Americans discouraged it. But I went to the black man who was instrumental in bringing something like 100,000 black soldiers from Africa to help in the First World War and really turn back the Germans. And D'Anio went to the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister said I could have the Congress. But, of course, America and Great Britain and so forth wouldn't allow anybody to have passports to get over there. So the Congress was rather small. We had 57 delegates, people, Negroes, who happened to be in Paris at the time, a few Africans, a few Negro Americans, and some whites. We had this first Pan-African Congress in 1919 at the Grand Hotel. And then after the World War, in 1921, we held a much larger Congress with some 200 or 300 people and a good many from Africa. And that aroused the colonial powers. They got very much excited because they thought I was trying to start a revolution in Africa, which I wasn't at all. What I was trying to do was to get educated Africans in various parts of the world to come together and know each other and talk with each other and see what kind of program could be laid down for the future emancipation of the Africans in their own country. I was held several Pan-African Congresses after that. There were none that were as great and comprehensive as the second in 1921, but there was one in 1923 in which leading Englishmen took part. That took place in London and Paris. And in 1924, I think, in Lisbon, where we got members of the Portuguese Parliament and some of the colonial officials. Then from there, I went to Africa because I never had been there. And while I was there, the President of the United States, Coolidge, appointed me Minister Plenipotentiary and Envoy Extraordinary to attend the inauguration of the President King. The real reason for that was that Liberia hadn't gotten any of the money that the United States was throwing about the world during the First World War. They were a little late in applying, and when they did apply, Congress wouldn't give it to them, so that Coolidge wanted to allay any bad feeling and gave me this appointment. That made me dean of the diplomatic corps in Monrovia, and I had a very important role to play. I tried to assure Liberia the friendship of the United States. Then I came back to the United States, and the next thing of importance was our anti-lynching campaign. We marched down Fifth Avenue, a silent march with placards. We spent, I think, some $20,000 in running advertisements in the great papers of the United States. We took a whole page in the New York Times. And we had a meeting here in New York City with a number of the leading citizens of the country, and really did something toward stopping the shame of lynching. Then I became interested in Russia. I had heard about the revolution of 1917 and tried to follow it, but there wasn't very good news coverage in the United States. And when a delegation of Soviet citizens came over here to try to induce Roosevelt to recognize the new government, they came to me thinking that perhaps I had some political influence so as to get recognition. I tried to assure them that I didn't have any political influence with Mr. Roosevelt or anybody else, and that I couldn't say much about Russia because I didn't know much, that the news was so contradictory. Well, they asked me if I wouldn't like to go to Russia, and I told them I would. provided I could go without any strings attached. And they said I could, and in 1926, I made my first trip to Russia. I traveled rather widely in Leningrad and Moscow, in Gorky, which used to be called Nizhny Novgorod, in the Ukraine, and down to the Black Sea and so forth. I had a very interesting trip. Then I went back to Russia in 1936, when I went across the Trans-Siberian Railroad from Moscow to Manchuria. And again in 1949, when I spoke to the Russian Peace Congress, and in 1958, the last time. So my interest in Russia became very great, and my belief in her work and her future, tremendous. On the other hand, in the United States, after the World War, and after the beginning of the rather feverish prosperity, I began to realize that something was going wrong with our economic organization because the income of the crisis began to fall off, and I began to see that Negroes were losing their jobs. The opposition to them in the trade union ranks was still strong, and it was clear that the crisis, as the Depression went on, was not going to pay for itself, not going to be self-supporting. Now, that brought a inevitable change. So long as the crisis was self-supporting, I could be practically independent within certain wide limits of what I was saying to the public. But if the National Association had to support the crisis, then of course the National Association had a right to have the last word as to what was to be said, and it would become an organ. And organs are never read because they're not interesting. They have to say what the Board of Trustees vote. So that I made up my mind that probably my job in propaganda was over. I was getting to be an old man, and I had a very attractive offer from my friend John Hope, down at Atlanta University, where I had taught before. John Hope had been made the president of a new university, which consisted of the old Atlanta University and of two or three other colored institutions, which were given a sufficient sum of money by the General Education Board to begin a new lease of life. And Hope was one of my closest friends, and he came several times to New York to ask me to come down there and help him start a real university. Now, it seemed to me that this was the time. My independence on the crisis had to be given up, and here was a chance to return to my ivory tower and go to work in study and writing. So that in 1933 I resigned. The NAACP gave me some very fine applause and did not want me to leave, but I thought it was the best thing to do. I went down to Atlanta University and stayed there 10 years. Unfortunately, Hope died the year after I got there. Worked himself to death. There succeeded a young man whom I had joined in recommending, but who, as a matter of fact, didn't know what a university should be and had no idea of the plans that Hope and I had. And then to one of the institutions that had gone into this making of a new university, Spelman College, a school for girls, also had at his head a woman who had worked for a long time for the Rockefellers. The Rockefellers had furnished the endowment for Spelman. And she held back. So that with this death and with the holding back of President Reed, it was a long time before I could get anything started. But finally, I got started a new quarterly magazine called Phylon, which is the Greek word for race. And then I got the Negro land-grant colleges to cooperate. Now, the Negro land-grant colleges were colleges which were supported by federal funds. There were some 20 colored and 20 or 30 white. And as a matter of fact, the white institutions got nearly all the money. The colored institutions got the scraps, and for a long time were really second-rate imitations of colleges. But they had begun to get more because they were getting a better class of presidents. And in the 30s, what they needed was a program. Some of them were headed by men whom I had taught, and the heads of others knew about me. So that I succeeded in getting those colleges to come together in an organization and to make Atlanta University the center of a new comprehensive study of the Negro problem. In fact, if I could have carried through that scheme, it would have been the largest sociological study that the world knew. There was bound to be quite enough money for it, because if the Negro colleges got their legal share of the federal appropriations, they would have three or four times as much money as they were getting. So that this looked like our great chance. We got the leading sociologists on our side, southern sociologists like Odom of North Carolina, like the head of the sociological department, the University of Louisiana, a large number of northern sociologists. We held one preliminary conference down in Atlanta, then held a second one where the thing really got going, and then the president of Atlanta University retired me for age. So that suddenly all of the new plan just flopped, because these institutions have naturally a good deal of jealousy against the Atlanta University and schools of that sort. And they were only willing to unite if I was at the head of it. It wasn't that I could do it any better than a good many others, but they knew me. They didn't know other people. So that the whole thing flopped. I simply had to give it up. For a while, I didn't know what I was going to do. The problem of even of self-support was loomed up. I had a wife and a daughter. The daughter was self-supporting, but I had built a new home in Baltimore, so it would be near where the daughter was teaching. And I had several offers of temporary work, lecturing at Fisk and at Durham and so forth. But an unexpected offer came from the NAACP. They wanted me to come back to the NAACP and to do anything I pleased at a salary equal to that anybody was getting. I would be perfectly free to end my life as I wished. Well, I hesitated because the head of the NAACP was Walter White, and I didn't like Walter White. He was a hard worker. He had built up the organization since I had left until it was a wide organization. But he was a phenomenally selfish man. And I laid down certain conditions. I told him I didn't want to interfere with the regular work of the NAACP at all. I didn't want to come back and try to resume my position as member of the board. But there were certain things, particularly connected with Africa and its development, which I would like to take up. And I want two offices, one for myself and one for my secretary and library. And that was all agreed to. And I came back. And immediately I ran into the difficulties that I had been afraid of. I didn't get an office at all. They didn't seem to be able to find one, or Walter didn't. And I couldn't get a clear program. And I began to realize that what Walter had in mind was that I should write speeches and reports and represent him, which was not what I had in mind, of course, at all. I finally did get a Pan-African Congress, or rather the trade unionists in Africa got one, invited me to Manchester, England in 1945, and there I met some of the great present leaders of Africa, Nkrumah of Ghana, and Johnson of Liberia, and Kenyatta of Kenya, and began to see the new spirit that was starting in Africa. But when I came back, it was proposed that we appeal to the United Nations. I had been a consultant at the United Nations for the NAACP when it was formed in 1945, that we should appeal to them and ask them to take up the matter of the treatment of Negroes in the United States. I edited a report of that sort, which I got other well-equipped people to help me writing different chapters. And Walter made difficulty about that. He wanted to write preface, which wasn't needed because my work in that was the preface. And that made more difficulty. And then Walter wanted me to make reports and so forth about what the United Nations do, and I didn't see that it was necessary at the time. There wasn't anything that was going to be done until somebody in the United Nations took up this matter, and nobody was going to do it against the United States. Then some inkling of this got out into the press. I didn't send it to the press, but I told the board of directors afterwards that the press had asked me. I always told them because there wasn't anything secret about it. But I was peremptorily dismissed in 1948 after I'd been there 4 years. Then I took up work as assistant chairman of the Council on African Affairs, which Paul Robeson was chairman, and which I had been interested in, although I hadn't been connected with it. But that was an unpaid job, and the witch hunt had begun in the United States, so that colored people were afraid to join this membership organization, and its income fell off. It was proposed, however, that before I withdrew from it, that they should unite in celebrating my 83rd birthday. And I consented, and we arranged a dinner of that sort. It was going to be up on at a hotel on Central Park South. And then there came an extraordinary development. I had attended the Great Congress of Arts and Sciences here at the Waldorf Astoria. A large number of Russians came. And we had a fine meeting, except it was ruined by an extraordinary attack. Nearly all the leading papers of the United States. One of the worst things that has happened in the United States. This was a meeting for peace, and it had some of the great leaders of the world, although certain leaders like Picasso, Bernal, and others were not given passports. At any rate, we did have a good meeting, and then the same year, 49, I went to Paris to attend the great Paris Peace Congress, which was, I think, on the whole, the greatest meeting of human beings I ever attended. It was a magnificent meeting. I took part and especially talked about colonies and emancipating colonies. Paul Robeson flew from Prague and took part and said that he didn't believe that colored men would ever join in any war against Russia. The Chinese were not allowed to come, but they telephoned the fall of Nanking from Prague to Paris. And I remember the night when the news came and the roar that went up. And then I was asked to come to Russia to a peace meeting. 25 Americans were asked to come with their expenses paid to this Russian peace meeting. I was the only one that went. I don't know why the others didn't go, but they probably were warned, and perhaps they didn't think it was necessary to warn me. I went there and tried to tell the Russians that the majority of Americans wanted peace, that they didn't want war and so forth. I made a long talk on that and published it carefully so that it wouldn't be misinterpreted. Then on my way back, I got a telegram from Mark Antonio saying that he was running for Congress and he wanted me to join the ticket and run for Senator in New York, and McManus was to run for governor. And I laughed the thing. I told him in the first place my age, and the second place I knew nothing about politics. And then they pled over the phone, and I said, all right. And I came over and made the campaign and got, I think it was 270,000 votes to my great surprise. Of course, that meant nothing in 3 million votes. But I did get a chance to speak plainly on certain ideas I had of clean politics. Well, then came this proposed dinner on my 83rd birthday. And in addition to that, we had formed, after this Paris meeting, a year later, a Peace Information Bureau. All we were doing was to publish what we call peacegrams once a month to tell the people of the United States what other nations were doing for peace. And when I got back here, I was notified that I would have to go down to Washington and register as a representative of a foreign government. And I wrote back and told them that was nonsense. I wasn't representing a foreign government. I was representing peace. They wouldn't listen to anything. And first thing I knew, I was indicted and threatened with 5 years in prison and a fine of $5,000. And I suddenly realized that this was a serious matter. It was going to cost a large sum of money, and I had no money. But my wife and I started out and made two or three trips across the country, passing the hat, in which I talked about socialism and Russia just as I had been talking, and she asked for contributions. She used to say that I used to make it pretty hard for her to get contributions, but the trial cost us $30,000, and that didn't count Mark Antonio's fee. He wouldn't charge anything. Otherwise, it would have cost $50,000. And, of course, it was thrown out of court. But even after that, we were punished. I mean, we couldn't get passports. And even up to this day, we're suspicious persons. lately, I've been encouraged by the fact that the young people, the students, have resumed leadership, which I was afraid that they had given up during the McCarthy era. I spoke at several institutions. I spoke at Princeton and Chicago and I think the University of Illinois, quite a number, but the students didn't respond. They seemed to me awfully dull. And I just made up my mind that this was an age where we were not going to have the inspiration of the young. And now, suddenly, without any encouragement on my part, and little encouragement on the part of others, comes this sit-down, where the students have put their finger on a very important point. The Negro problem, of course, is a problem of mob violence and of disfranchisement and of injustice in the courts and of difficulties in getting decent jobs. It's all that. But in addition to that, the Negro problem is a series of little meannesses which are really unimportant, that help nobody, and yet which all of the Negroes have to meet, and which most of them simply meet and say nothing. I mean the fact that you go downtown shopping, you can't get a sandwich or a cup of coffee. There are towns down there where you can't sit in the park. You can't go to the movies, or if you do go, you have to go to a very unpleasant place right at the top. All sorts of things of that kind which have been going on, and which in my day we simply said, well, gracious, we've got to stop people being murdered if they can't get a cup of coffee, that's a little thing. But the students put their finger on that, and they fought, and it was hard fighting. I went down to North Carolina and saw some of them and heard the story of what they've been doing. And they have kept it up. And it's really a part of a worldwide movement of students. The students in Turkey who made it impossible for Mr. Menderes to give his welcoming speech to NATO. To the tremendous revolution in South Korea, where they got rid of a scoundrel, and of other student movements, and then of course of the great awakening of Africa. Well, that gives me a good deal of satisfaction. Evidently, the older people like myself are not needed just now. There are younger people who are going on and doing their own thinking, and I congratulate them upon it. They don't need any advice from me. Perhaps I need some from them. In the earlier days, in the latter part of the 18th century, in the beginning of the 19th century, the Negroes in America considered themselves African. They called their organizations African. There were African clubs. There was the African Methodist Episcopal Church and the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church and so forth. Then there arose a movement among the whites to help them return to Africa. And the Negroes suddenly realized that what they were doing was to get rid of the free Negroes and of the more intelligent Africans so that they could have only Negro slaves here. So there came a tremendous revulsion of feeling. And from the middle of the 19th century on, there was one thing that American Negroes were determined not to do, and that was to return to Africa. Anybody that talked about return to Africa was not in good odor. Then there came the efforts in Liberia and so forth, which were pretty difficult, and Sierra Leone. Bishop Turner, Bishop of the African Church, tried to encourage some migration to Africa, but didn't succeed. And then with my Pan-African Congress movement, there came the idea that American Negroes, having better chance at education and so forth, could help the African But that was bitterly opposed by the colonial powers. They didn't want any American Negroes out there stirring up trouble. And the Negroes in America were not particularly enthusiastic. For instance, the NAACP supported the first two Pan-African Congresses, but not the others, because, as some of the trustees said, we've got enough problems here in the United States without going to Africa to look up others. So that there wasn't much American Negro support for the Pan-African movement. Now, on the other hand, there comes through the African trade unions a renewal of thought and ambition among a new generation of Africans. When the African members of trade unions met in Paris with the trade unionists of the world, they found, to their surprise, and they fought it, that the English trade unions, for instance, wanted to speak for the African trade unions. Well, the African trade unions said they were there and they're perfectly able to talk for themselves. And they won. And that was the reason for the split that came in the trade union movement. Meantime, the Africans there asked for a fifth Pan-African Congress, and that's the reason that fifth Pan-African Congress began. Now, they were the people that went back to Africa and began this new movement. And today, the leadership of the Negro race is going to come from Africa and not from America or the West Indies. In fact, they are going to inspire work here that we haven't been doing. And for that reason, you have this tremendous beginning of independence and autonomy and freedom from white rule in Africa. Now, on the other hand, the American Negroes have become very much American. And a good many of the American Negroes see now a chance in Africa to make money. And, of course, the whites have always seen that chance. So that you have here in New York City today some four organizations which are African organizations and which believe themselves or pretend to believe that they are helping the African movement. As a matter of fact, most of them are trying to help American investors get in on the ground floor in Africa. And that I've tried to set myself against. Africa needs capital, but what I've said, I broadcasted from China last year, you need capital, and you must save your own capital just as much as possible. And you must avoid getting capital from the United States, which is going to tie you down so that you will be unable to be really free if you are part of the investment system. That if you can get capital from the Soviet Union at 2%, you ought to get it. If you can get it from China, help with that sort. The point is to get capital, but to get it as cheaply as possible, save it for yourself, and not tie yourself up by spending a whole lot for consumers' goods that you haven't gotten on for a long time without refrigerators or automobiles in Africa. You can get on a little further than that. And for that reason, I'm not a member of any of these African organizations and haven't been asked to be a member. And I have warned the Africans, as I've said. I was asked to go to Ghana when the country first became independent, and I couldn't get a passport. Now, Ghana is going to become a republic, and I'm going to be invited there, and I've applied for a passport. I probably won't get it, but if I do get it, I'm going there and tell them the same thing with emphasis. A good many of the Americans, the American Negroes particularly, are naive about that. They, for instance, there is a firm down on Wall Street of colored investors who are telling the Negro people, now you ought to invest in bonds and get some of this income. But what I'm saying to them, there's no use you're going into that gambling organization and think you're going to get anything out of it. That's simply throwing away your money. But a number of American Negroes don't understand this. A man came the other day here. I think personally he was honest with a whole lot of my books, which he wanted me to autograph. But I thought, here's a friend of mine who's collecting books, and I'll autograph. And I sat down there and wrote my name in those books for about an hour. And then as I was writing, it suddenly occurred to me, well, this is a little queer. And I find out he's acting as agent for a Madison Avenue organization which is collecting my books, and I believe it. So when he came with another batch, I told him he could take them back. I wasn't autographing anymore. Well, now, I don't think he was personally dishonest, but that's his idea of American business. It's too bad, because I don't think that the Africans are going to fall for it. I think they're going to be rather careful and build up a new independent organization for the benefit of the mass of the people, instead of the making of millionaires who are going to cooperate with millionaires in England and America.
Welcome back, and that was the voice of Dr. W.B. Du Bois from a oral interview from 1961. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast on this Tuesday, April the 23rd, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
I know I treated you wrong. Oh, how much is it? clothes back home. Oh, bring your clothes back home.
Welcome back, and that was Mr. McKinley Morganfield, popularly known as Muddy Waters, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit on this Tuesday afternoon, April the 23rd, 2024. Right now, we'll move into a Langston Hughes-focused audio file discussing the blues that we just heard from Muddy Waters, some of the people who performed with Muddy Waters in that previous soundtrack, of course, will appear in this discussion. Let's listen in.
This is the blues, harmonica, James Cotton, piano, Otis Spann. The blues in the Louis Sullivan Room of Roosevelt University, and Louis Sullivan, known for his good acoustics of the buildings he designed, and was seated next to Langston Hughes, who you might call as a quadruple threat man, poet, composer, playwright, novelist, short. Langston and Brother John Sellers is here too, whom we'll hear in a moment. Langston, what is the blues? How would you describe it?
Well, the blues are certainly the roots of jazz, the basic heartbeat behind America's most popular music. And out of the blues have come many, many great melodic compositions, ranging all the way from the raw folk blues, not written down, to the W.C. Handy, the Clarence Williams compositions, J.P. Johnson, to the use that composers like George Gershwin have made of blues themes. Rhapsody in Blue, Porgy and Bess, the French ballet, you know, with Nola Dame, was really a blues ballet adopted by a French arranger-composer.
The blues has served so many purposes. I'm thinking of you, how the blues itself has affected practically all your writings in one way or another, hasn't it?
Well, it's affected my poetry, shall we put it that way, a great deal, and possibly my prose to a certain extent, because the blues, the lyrics of the blues, not speaking of the music now, the lyrics have a great warmth and humanity usually in them, and often very deep sadness, but always somewhere in a blues there's a twist that makes people laugh. In other words, there's humor in the blues too. And I certainly have, to some extent, carried that over into my prose, particularly in my simple books.
I'm thinking of, as you said, something here that is too rarely said, that there's a humor, there's an affirmation in the blues too, as well as a sadness.
Oh, yes. You know, the verse that I often quote, which I heard many, many years ago in Kansas City as a child, illustrates that. The one about, I'm going down to the railroad, lay my head on the track. Going down to the railroad, lay my head on the track. But if I see the train a-coming, I'll jerk it back.
The will to live is there no matter how adverse the circumstance.
Yeah.
Well, Langston, as James Cotton and Otis Spann are here and playing oh so soulfully, perhaps some of your varied projects and works. And I'm thinking specifically something happened a couple of weeks ago while Otis and James are still here. At the Newport Jazz Festival, which we heard ended rather suddenly and shockingly.
Sadly.
Yet, were you emceeing the very last session? Do you mind telling us about that?
Well, the night before the Sunday afternoon program, the third night of the festival this year, there were riots in the streets which had really nothing to do with jazz. It simply had to do with the fact that the town was very much overcrowded, that there were perhaps 15,000 young people who, some who couldn't get into the park and others who had no intention of going to hear the jazz program, were outside in the streets. And the park was crowded, sold out, but quiet. The program was quite wonderful. There were people like Ray Charles and Horace Silver Quintet playing, and a very wonderful crowd inside the park enjoying the music. But outside there were young people, and they were not teenagers on the whole. They were college age and older, who decided to have fun by throwing beer cans over the fence and hitting people in the head who were sitting
there
listening
to
music.
They weren't really jazz fans.
They weren't really jazz fans. They were folks out to have a good time at any cost, and they had loaded up their cars with cases of beer, and then some of them decided to try to rush the gate, and that really began the riots, and the police were inadequate, unfortunately, and those who tried to rush the gate did not succeed in getting in, but they did succeed in starting a battle with the police, and other young people joined in by throwing beer cans, and not empty ones, full
so
beer
cans. So the people who wanted to hear jazz are the ones who were the losers.
Who are the losers, and it developed into a riot of not the enormous proportions that the newspapers might have indicated, but it was only around about four blocks.
Mike, there's something poetically tragic here about this very last session. You were emceeing a session Sunday afternoon, the very last of Newport.
Yes, and quite by accident it happened to be the blues. And none of us knew, of course, that that would be the final session. And just before the program began, the city council met to decide what to do about the festival or the rest of it for the season. And being quite irate at what had gone on the night before, about 1 o'clock, they announced that they had withdrawn the license for the festival forever, which not only canceled the remaining programs, but next season and ever thereafter. However, my afternoon program was allowed to go on because they hadn't made up their minds by that time, and it just happened to be a program on the blues, so since it was a sad afternoon, it was appropriate that the blues end the festival. And when I heard this news, I was already at the park, so I went into the press room, and I didn't have any paper or anything with me, and got a Western Union Telegraph blank and wrote, "A blues for Newport. Goodbye, Newport Blues."
Yes, this is a blues written on the spot.
Written right on the spot, which I imagine is the way many blues began, out of some sad event.
I was just about to
Otis Spann had a ride with the Muddy Waters Band, and I asked if he would be so kind as to play it and sing it, and he'd never seen it before, so quite spontaneously, he gave this blues a melody. And out of this sad event, within a couple of hours, grew this blues with which we closed the whole afternoon. And on the stage at the time when we closed were all the members of the Muddy Waters Band, including the harmonica player here, and Sammy Price Trio, Butch Cage and Willie Lewis
from Louisiana,
and Jimmy Rushing, who was sitting in the audience, came up and joined us in the last jam session. And all of these people took part in this finale singing "A Gloomy Day at Newport." This
Since Otis Spann is here at the piano and James Cotton with the mouth harp, with the harmonica, perhaps recreating this event, this moment, singing what you wrote, hot from the flush of that moment, you know. In the Newport Blues, sad day at Newport.
Yes.
from a dead new foe.
Just as we hear Otis's voice and piano and James Cotton's mouth harp fade out, I'm looking at an item in the Providence Journal of that day, of that next morning, and it ends in this way. It's a few moments later, after an original blues tune at the end of the Newport Jazz, the performers walked silently off the stage. Audience began shuffling out, many of them wet-eyed. Two men began dismantling the canvas walls. A technician dismantled the microphones on the stage. Someone closed the piano. Langston Hughes with a trembling voice said, "Goodbye, Newport." And it's remarkable, Langston, how this real sadness is imbued in the very song itself that you composed at that moment.
Well, the blues have that quality, and many, many blues have been made up spontaneously. So I think this is sort of in the true tradition of the blues, that out of this event on the spot, there came this song. And it was a very sad moment, but my feeling is that the City Fathers of Newport will reconsider during the summer.
I hope so. One of your recent works, so many works, is From Tambourines to Glory, the story of these two gospel women and their adventures. Tell us about this. There's a project in mind, aside from the book.
Yes, it grew from a series of gospel songs that I wrote about 10 years ago, And they were not recorded, although Mahalia Jackson liked some of them very much and said she hoped to do them. So I thought, well, I'll write a play and put the songs in the play. And I did. The play went around Broadway for 3 or 4 years and got favorable comments, but no one took it. So I said, well, I'll write a novel. So from the play, I wrote the novel, Tambourines to Glory. And the novel had scarcely been out a week before producers began to call up and say, it'd make a wonderful play. And I said, well, I have the play. And they said, it should be a play with music. And I said, well, I have the music. And so almost immediately after the novel appeared, the Theater Guild optioned the play about a year ago. And, of course, it takes a long time to get things into the theater. But eventually they got around to auditioning, to casting. And in about 2 weeks, the rehearsals are scheduled to start for the dramatic version, Tambourines to Glory.
And I know this is a very delightful book. It's a book of a great deal of, how shall we call it, the raciness of life in it. It's a juice of life. And before we talk about the cast and about Brother John, who's in it too, gospel music. I mean, you like the blues, and of course you like gospel music. Would you mind telling us of the connection? And, you know, some
well,
people
of course,
feel as a line, you know.
Gospel music is a modern religious music of the Negro people, and it grew out of, melodically, out of the spirituals and the blues too, and its foremost composer, Dorsey, Thomas A. Dorsey,
who lives in Chicago,
by the way, and who wrote some very beautiful gospel songs, Precious Lord, Take My Hand, he himself, his first musical interest was the blues. And many years ago, he was the pianist for the great old blues singer, Ma Rainey. And so naturally...
That's Georgia Tom.
Yes, and naturally when he came over into the gospel field, he carried certain qualities of that music, the blues music, with him. And when you hear Mahalia Jackson, many people have compared her style of singing to that of the great blues singer, Bessie Smith. Although, of course, Mahalia sings religious songs, not blues, but in those songs and in the way of singing them, there is much of the quality of the singers of the blues.
Well, thinking of Tambourines to Glory, then, that will have gospel music as its base.
Yes.
I think Hazel Scott is cast in it.
Hazel Scott has the leading role of the woman who wants to found a church along with a friend of hers, a good woman. And Hazel plays the woman who's sort of interested only in making money out of religion. So we have the old struggle between good and evil in terms
material
of the church.
The spiritual.
Yes.
Now, Brother John is leaving in Chicago, and he's going to... What role will Johnny Sellers play in this?
Well, we had sort of hoped to have him for the deacon, but we are not sure at the moment, but it's certain that he's going to be in it, and he's a great tambourine player, as you know, and the title of the play is Tambourines to Glory. And among other duties that he is to have is to coach all of the people in the play on how to play a gospel tambourine.
Well, I think that John can do that without any inhibitions. I'm thinking, you mentioned, well, Brother John, have you any idea what song you will sing in that?
No, because I've seen several songs in the script, but since I don't know just what part I'm playing, I wouldn't know what.
You know what occurred to me? I think of Brother John's Baptist shouts and gospel songs for Monitor that are so good. And since a while ago, Langston mentioned Professor Dorsey and Precious Lord.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Jenny knows that, and there's Otis there, you know, and since we live really two lives, there is, it's true that gospel songs are one world and blues are another, yet a man can find a way. As Johnny doesn't know this. You think it's possible, perhaps, of a... What do you think, like Precious Lord?
If we could, perform that as a tribute to Dorsey, because I admire him greatly, and he happens to be Chicago's, in my opinion, perhaps one of Chicago's most distinguished composers, you know?
Well, Brother John, Otis, James, have you decided on the key? What do you think?
Yeah, I can just start, and you can just pick me up,
right.
Otis. Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand, I am tired.
I am weak, I am worn. Through the storm, through the night, lead me on to the light. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me on. When my way grows dream, precious Lord,
the first time, you know, that gospel music has been used in the Broadway Theater. It'll be its introduction to the world of show business, really. And in my opinion, the Negro churches that use this music are, in a sense, the last refuge of true Negro folk singing, you know? Nobody tampers with those singers. They sing as they feel, as they wish. They're not told what to do by record executives or musical directors. And so much of our folk music is being sort of polluted or diluted, certainly, by the jukebox, by the radio, by television.
A&R men, the
recording
companies.
You go all over the country now, and many of the youngsters are trying to sing like Nat King Cole or somebody they hear on the radio, you see. And that is not true of the churches yet. And so folk music still there is in a pure form.
Something you said here about the church being the last refuge of the true gospel music, isn't this true too because the audience, the call and response is there too?
Oh yes, and everyone
takes... Otis was calling out a moment ago.
Everyone takes part in it, you see, and nothing is planned. It's all spontaneous and real and wonderful.
You know, I was thinking, as we're talking now, we're going to come to other subjects of Langston. We'll hear Otis and James. I'm thinking, while Johnny's still here, since we talked about response, called audience, the element of demonstration, too. I know Johnny does this so well. Demonstrating.
Yes.
Sing on.
Yes.
John, would you mind? I know Johnny does this often, but I never get tired. Did you ever hear John sing Sing On?
No, I don't believe I have, but before he does it, may I simply say this, that... as you know, next week I have a book coming out called An African Treasury.
I know.
Which has a number of articles, essays, by black Africans. Everything in the book is by indigenous Africans. Poetry, stories, and so on. And among the articles are two quite excellent ones on African songs. One on African work songs, and another on African poetry and music. By a great African musicologist who's been in this country recently, Rockefeller Foundation. Mm-hmm. And he says in there a great deal about this call and response, mm-hmm. which is carried over from Africa into the Negro churches here.
I mean, I want to ask about this book, the African Treasury, as we go along, because I know this is certainly it's so timely.
I simply wanted to point out the carryovers from Africa
yes.
in our Negro music.
I want to come
America.
Back to that, to mm-hmm. the Africa and the cinema, African music. Perhaps while John is still here, the matter of sing on. Johnny, would you mind telling us what you mean by demonstrating?
Well, what I mean by demonstrating in the churches, you know, like years ago, I used to see Mahalia when she was with the Johnson Singers. And these singers, oh, this has been 25, maybe 30 years ago, they would demonstrate.
Don't let Mahalia say that.
They would demonstrate in their songs, like they would sing songs like they were looking for the storm that was hewed out the mountain. Or maybe they would, the Bible would be placed in one particular place in the church, and they would sing until they said they found the storm, and they would show it. And that's, they'd walk all around and using their hands and making emotions. That's what I mean by demonstrating. You heard me out at the church yeah. one time when we had to thank for Big Bill, sing on, and yeah. how I showed how
to By the way, I should like to, while we're here, mention this concert. When is this Baptist Shout Gospel song?
Oh, this is Sunday afternoon.
Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. At 9044 South Cottage Grove.
South Cottage
Grove. St. John's Temple.
And we should point out, too, that Otis Spann works with Muddy Waters, one of our finest blues singers, at Smitty's Corners, I believe, on 35th Indiana. And James Cotton works there, too. We'll ask later on about the mouth harp and about the piano. But, Jenny, is it possible? I know the microphone is stationary here, and you need room for singing out. But is
it
possible?
You know, if I'm in the church, I need room.
Yeah. But here can you sort of do it?
Yeah,
here?
Well, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
All right.
And you can catch it, or it's just a thing. Now you sing on. Sing on, my singer. Hey, you sing on. Sing on, my leader. Hey, you sing on. Sing, my singer. I know the Lord. He'll hear you sing. Hey, you sing on. Sing, my singer. And don't you worry about your leader. Put on my shoes, I'm gonna walk around in the fun. Tell the good news, I'm going to tell on my side, King Jesus. I'm gonna tell him about my troubles, and I'll be talking to the Lord. Oh Lord, my way is dark, along the journey. My way is dark, along the journey. It's dark along the journey, but I know the Lord, He'll hear my prayer. My way is dark along the journey, but don't you worry about your singer. Well, when I get here, I'm gonna put on my shoes, I'm gonna walk around in heaven. Heard the good news, I'm gonna tell him about King Jesus. I'm gonna tell him about my troubles, and I'll be talking to the Lord. Oh Lord, sometimes I cry along this journey. Sometimes I cry along this journey.
Sometimes I cry along this journey, but I know the Lord is gonna hear my cry. Oh, church, I cry along the journey, and not you worry about Brother John. For when I get to heaven, put on my shoes, I'm gonna walk around in heaven. Tell the good news, I'm going to set all beside King Jesus. Tell him about my troubles, and I'll be talking to the Lord. Oh Lord, my way is dark along the journey. My way is dark along this journey. My way is dark along this journey. But I know the Lord is gonna hear my prayer. My way gets dark along this journey. But don't you worry about your Savior. Well, it's when I get heaven, put on my shoes, I'm gonna walk from the altar. I'm gonna tell the good news. I'm going to sit on beside King Jesus. I'm gonna tell him about my troubles, and I'll be talking with the Lord. Oh Lord.
Langston, and just as Brother John is saying that there, showing them how it's done, really, is what it amounts to. Showing them how to do it, how to reach where you want to get. And where you want to get is pretty definitely a higher place.
Yes, indeed.
Langston and Brother John, thanks. We'll come back, and I'm going to come to Otis and James. Langston, I think about the poetry. You're here, too, in Chicago, in connection with the filming. Just finished of Raisin in the Sun, being made into a film.
And yes, I am. They're using a poem of mine as a spoken prologue to the picture. They printed it in the theater program, but it was not in the play. However, it's going to actually be spoken in the play in the movie by Sidney Poitier.
This is the very beginning.
Yes.
Right. Would you mind reading that to us, Langston?
The poem is called Dream Deferred, and one line in the poem gave the title to the play, the line Raisin in the Sun. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sower and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode?
And there, out of this simple yet very eloquent poem, the whole theme of Raisin in the Sun itself, Walter Lee Younger's yen problem, that of his mother, of course. And Lorraine Hansberry, then, in reading your poem, I got the idea for the title, isn't that, from the play?
Yes, I think perhaps she'd already written the play, but Miss Hansberry was kind enough to say that my poetry has had quite an influence on her work and that she read it as a child, you know?
Well, since we're thinking of Raisin in the Sun, Lorraine Hansberry, think of one of the figures in the play, the African student, you know,
yes.
How affirmative he seems in a strange environment for him, and yet he seems to understand it, and which is, I think, a perfect lead into the anthology of yours, this African treasure, an African treasury that is published, the publishers are
Crown.
Crown.
Mm-hmm.
And what are stories, poems, articles, essays? Would you mind telling us about this anthology?
Well, it's a result of an interest of mine in African writing for some 6 or 7 years, and the boiling down of this collection to a dozen or so essays and stories and a dozen or so poems and some miscellaneous items. We even have letters to the Lovelorn from African newspapers.
I have that there, too.
Yes, and quite a deal of humor. Came about by my being chosen to be a judge of an African short story contest about 7 years ago now, for the magazine Drum. And among these
Drum,
stories...
Drum, the magazine
in Johannesburg,
in
South
Johannesburg,
Africa.
And it's
yes.
also published in Ghana, too, isn't it? Ghana,
yes,
Ghana
and it's published exclusively for colored readers. The words colored and black and Negro, you know, don't mean the same abroad as they do here. And they don't use the word Negro really in Africa at all. And so perhaps the word black covers the whole native population. And we call the anthology a collection of work by black Africans. At any rate, it took several years to gather the material, hundreds of manuscripts, several hundred dollars in airmail postage, 25 cents to mail a letter to Africa, you know, many manuscripts that had to be returned. But eventually, I got together what I feel to be a representative selection from such widely scattered countries as Kenya in Northeast Africa to South Africa itself, Ghana, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, Madagascar. And it is really the most comprehensive collection of work by Africans of color, native indigenous Africans, ever to be published in the world, probably.
Is there a recurring theme among the...
Well, if you might say there is a main theme, it's a sort of pride in Africanness, a pride in their own country, a pride in blackness, really, and an assurance and a hope for their own future. And, of course, through almost everything runs the current African feeling for freedom to govern themselves, to run their own affairs, even if they do make mistakes. And we've had very splendid books on Africa, John Gunther's book, Inside Africa, the Alan Paton books, the Nadine Gordimer novels, all very fine.
Basil Davidson, The Lost
Cities
of Africa.
Oh, very fine books, but all by whites, you see. And to get the real African native feeling, it seems to me important that we also read what the black Africans are writing, and that is what this book is. Yes. It will be out next week, by the way.
Next week, stories, yeah. Articles, essays of sorts. There's one that's intriguing, the African and Africa and the cinema.
Oh, yes, there's an excellent article there by J. Koyindi Vaughan of Nigeria, who's really a lawyer, but in his spare time he writes about movies. And there's an excellent piece about the stereotypes that plague the commercial movies done in Africa or done about Africa, you know. And most of them, of course, are from the colonial viewpoint and have almost nothing in them of modern Africa, of the fact that there are Africans who are chemists, who run machines, who control ports, who take customs. All the movies show are the witch doctors and boom, 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 tom, tom, tom.
I'm curious what with films like Raisin of the Sun. Of course, this is the American Negro, but I'm wondering if there eventually, because of what is happening in the world, the changes in the whole filmmaker's approach.
Oh, of course they will. Sidney Poitier was just talking on location today about that, and he was saying that some of the African governments are already setting up their own film units, largely for documentaries at the moment, but eventually they will be able to make films of entertainment value, film African stories and so on, you know.
I noticed in the table of contents here, partial table of contents, some names that are quite familiar. Peter Kumalo.
Yeah,
South
he's
Africa,
a very good writer. And
Peter Abrams.
Who, of course, is a refugee from apartheid. He lives in Jamaica now.
And these are some of the better-known writers, and then there are...
We have some of the political writers. We have Nkrumah
and Tom Mboya.
And Mboya, mm-hmm. And we have a very amusing and interesting piece by an African who studied in this country, his impressions of America.
That should be very funny.
Yeah.
That's Bob's Fafunwa.
Fafunwa, uh-huh.
Fafunwa. Well, this book, then, will be out sometime in the middle of July.
It will be out, to be exact, July 25th.
An African Treasury, edited Langston Hughes, Crown. And certainly, I think it's an addition to anyone's library who wants to know and who doesn't. What is happening in a very vital part of the world? And we may return now to this world of ours here. We opened with the blues. Remember, we opened with the blues, and then we heard Brother John and some gospel songs. And by the way, when will... Did we mention Tambourines de Glory's time of opening?
Yes, I think it goes into rehearsal... in a couple of weeks, and the plan is to open it in Summer Theater, Westport, Labor Day week, and then to tour for 8 weeks if things work out well.
Well,
and
I think,
then go to New York.
I think with Brother John Sellers in this cast, Hazel Scott better watch out.
It should work out well.
Now, if we may wander a minute to, I'd like to just talk with Otis and with James for a minute about the music. Otis, I know that John is in Greenville, Mississippi, and... Langston was Cleveland, but Kansas City Missouri originally. Where are you from, Otis?
I'm from Pelatchie, Mississippi, which is a small, small town.
What about the piano, you and music? When did this come into being?
My father, he is a piano player. And when I got old enough to play, he used to carry me around with him, in which we had a house, you know, like this. Well, on a Saturday night, the only time the people around my neighborhood could get out. You understand?
Yeah.
And we'd have fish fries, which me and my father used to go muddy creeks and catch the fish and have our own fish fries.
Have your own fish fries.
That's right. You could have fish sandwich for 10 cents.
Uh-huh. And so you had music with that.
That's right. We had music with this. And back in the back, we're doing something else, gambling. But that's just the way my hometown was. And we.
What about you learning the piano? How did you learn the piano?
That's the way I learned, because.
By yourself?
During that time, there was a fellow by the name of Coot Davis. He called himself the Emperor of the Irie, which he was.
He was the Emperor of the Irie.
The Emperor of the Irie. So. He came from England, and he taught me. I was only 6 years old. But after I got up some size, I got off his style of playing. And I got on the style of Muddy Waters, which had been Muddy Waters 17 years.
Been with Muddy 17 years.
17 years.
And you worked with Willie Dixon, too, then.
I worked with Willie Dixon, too, sure.
And so we have at least a beginning, the understanding of Otis Spann and his blues piano. I'm looking at James Cotton now here. Yes. Where are you from, James?
I'm from Tunica, Mississippi.
What about the harmonica? How'd you take to the harmonica?
Well, my brother, he used to play the harmonica, you know. I'd sit around the house and look at him play the harmonica, because me and him played the same harmonica, you know. And because that I couldn't get the sounds out of it that he get, I used to go in the bedroom and cry, you know, because I wanted to make it sound like that. So we kept on that, and he kept on showing me a few things till finally I learned how to play one song, Sitting on Top of the World. And then he quit playing the harp. Then I started playing the harp. First time I ever played the harp and got paid.
Basically, the harp sometimes is what the harmonica is called.
Harmonica.
That's
right. And after I started playing the harmonica pretty good, I got a lucky break when I was about 12, I guess. I started playing with a guy by the name of Howlin' Wolf.
Oh, the Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah. Howlin' Wolf. Yeah. I played with him 4 years. He was the first one to give me a break to play the harmonica. Then after him, I didn't know the things that I should have known about it then. After him, I met Sonny Boy.
Williamson.
And he showed me a whole lot about it. And after Sonny Boy, I performed my own band. And then after that, I come with Muddy Waters. And Muddy Waters showed me everything that I think that you can learn about it.
So I think since we opened, James Cotton noticed, to open with the blues. And Langston here is saying, let's close with the blues. I'm sure Brother John would agree, because this, again, we come back to the seeds, don't we? So, gentlemen, a blues. A blues.
Stop drinking and gambling, baby. People that
myself if I could do that. Yes, you know, I wish I could stop drinking, gambling. People that I won't run around. Cause I'm just a poor country boy. You know I'm running from door to door. I didn't have a chance to go to school. Cause I didn't have a chance to do what right. Yes, I didn't have a chance to go to school. People didn't have a chance to do what right. I didn't have a chance for self-span. Cause I was a poor country boy. Go to bed with full night. Watch out, Jim
Nothing but a good man feeling bad.
Blues ain't nothing but a landlord knocking on the gate.
Blues ain't nothing but that mean old heart disease.
The blues ain't nothing but a woman on a good man's mind.
The blues is sitting here wondering, will a matchbox hold all my clothes?
And on that note, Langston Hughes, the blues with about as many definitions as there are singers, as there are people in the world, as there are moods. Say thank you very much, gentlemen. Otis Spann at the piano and James Cotton at the harmonica and Brother John Sellers with his gospel music and soon and Tambourine to Glory and, of course, Langston Hughes, quadruple, quintuple fret man. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ted Sterkel.
Welcome back. Another tribute to Langston Hughes, along with Otis Spann and James Cotton, Muddy Waters. And that's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast. We'll be closing out with the music of Tiny Grimes and J.C. Higginbotham, Calling the Blues from 1958. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Thank you.